So hi everybody, good morning and welcome to anybody else online. So as you can see, this class is called Samsara and Nirvana, and we're on to the second episode. We'll begin as we normally do by taking refuge together, saying a few prayers. During the class we'll begin, and during it of course there's room for discussion, questioning, and also a space for meditation. So let's begin. By taking refuge and generating a mind of enlightenment. So this requires you to, first of all, comfortable in your seat. So just check your posture. Make sure that your back is straight. Your neck is sitting evenly on your head is sitting evenly on your neck. Your eyes be partially closed or fully closed, whatever suits you. And just let your body breathe itself. And while your body continues to breathe itself, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha sitting on a golden throne. The Buddha is made of golden light. He's wearing three robes and he's surrounded by your spiritual mentors, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and awakened beings. Meanwhile, surrounding you are all sentient beings. These include your parents, family members, close friends, difficult people and strangers. Think of you leading all these people into a state of full enlightenment, whereby their mental continuum is suffused with great compassion, wisdom realizing emptiness, and the power that is able to help others. Helping others to abandon every afflictive mental state and to develop all of their good qualities. And I'm putting your hands together in the prayer mudra. Join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Imagine that from the heart of the Buddha and the heart of each other enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream forth. They wash over you and over all the people surrounding you. And every hindrance to your spiritual development is washed away. And the potential for your goodness to flourish is made apparent. You recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. You decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings in these four boundless states. And to affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And again, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down, washing over you and over all the people surrounding you. And everything that prevents the realization of these four boundless thoughts is washed away. And you find that these four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity now effortlessly manifest. So we recollect the kindness of the Buddha and the spiritual entourage. Recognize that there is still space above you. And then join me in saying, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all negative actions accumulated since the beginning of time and rejoice in the merit of holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, stop ourselves on clinging to the merit of accumulated. Recollect that all phenomena are empty of any intrinsic nature, do exist in mere name, meaning phenomena are dependent upon consciousness and the naming process. So imagine that your body, speech, and mind, your merits, every object of your senses is utterly transformed through your knowledge. It reappears as a pure land, whereby you can give teachings to students in the future. And you want to offer this pure land to the Buddha and the spiritual entourage. And so you say, this ground, anointed with perfume, stirring with flowers, adorned with mountain air, four continents, surrounding me. I imagine this as a Buddha fearing effort. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnamanda Kamaryataya. So I've released the offering and the Buddha has accepted it with delight. He smiles at you. And you look up and gaze into the smiling eyes of the Buddha. Feel yourself accepted, feel at ease, and understand that all of your wishes in terms of this path will be met and accomplished. But now the emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space. And it comes to abide above the crown of your head, but facing in the same direction you are. And the emanation begins to descend, coming down through the crown of your head, down through your throat and into your chest, resting at the level of your heart. Now the light of the emanation begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light and nectars. And these pour out through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. And thereby establishing every being within space to now be within the enlightened state. You hear the sound of the mantra resonating. And you join in saying, and then you shall find that you breath for a minute or so. Now the lights begin to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and re-enter your heart. Imagine that you've accomplished the two purposes. And then realize that this meditation is one of pure imagination yet it has imprinted the mind with the potential for what we wish for to be accomplished. So again, just affirm that you're studying the Dharma, coming along to these classes, because you want to develop your wisdom, your compassion, every other skill you have, to the full capacity, so that you can help others attain the same enlightenment. And breathing into your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter open at your close. So these are some of the materials that we relied upon to present this morning's class. You can see there's quite a lot here about the Four Noble Truths. And that's the major thrust of today's teachings. These, right up here in the corner, are called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment. This is one of the books by Geshe Sopa. And this particular book is called Karma. As you can see, it's got nearly 500 pages in it. And it covers the Four Noble Truths, the 12 links of dependent origination, three higher trainings, all these sort of topics that we'll be going through. Down the bottom, all four books there are written by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Venerable Thupten Jodrung. And do you forget we're going to buy a set of books? These are the ones. I'll take you right through, you go back to them again and again. They're really well written, easy to understand, and quite deep and wide. Now, last week, we looked at samsara and nirvana, along with renunciation, liberation, and enlightenment. So just briefly, could somebody tell me what they remember about samsara? Do you want to remember the definition of it, or one of the synonyms for it? But samsara is suffering, yes, it is.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Cycle of rebirth, of the contaminated aggregates, some of the influence of karma and afflictions.
That's pretty close to it. Yeah. Other things you could remember is just the acronym of being sad, it's striving, being achieving it, and then being disappointed or disillusioned, and then you do it again. Another term they use was it's not quite right. That's as far as the situation, it's not quite right. Trungpa Rinpoche described it as it's like it's all mixed up. But as Callan said, it's the cycle of rebirth of the contaminated and appropriate aggregates which occurs under the control of karma and delusion. It was quite a mouthful. What about renunciation? Does anybody recollect what renunciation is? Yeah, an aspiration to be free from samsara. So to be in a state free from the karma and the afflictions. And liberation, what's that? Yeah, this is the freedom. This is the actual freedom that renunciation, the wisdom realizing into this, produces, so that you can actually be free from samsara. Okay, and so enlightenment, of course, here we're talking about the great enlightenment of Buddhahood.
Anthea chimed in that for her, samsara is a self-pitying state of mind controlled by karma and affliction, confusion, and mental reactivity. And she also answered with liberation from samsara is the moment a person completely frees themselves from suffering because they've abandoned afflictive obscurations and their seeds without exception, experiencing true cessation.
Wow, good on you, Anthea. That's a full answer. That's correct, too. Yeah. So now, today, we're going to have a look at how samsara and nirvana sort of talked about from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. So we look at what these phenomena are. Now there are four of them, of course. There's the truth of dukkha, truth of origin, truth of cessation, truth of path. We'll look at each of these. I'll tell you a little bit about them. And then probably at the end you're going to be, oh my gosh, it's so full on. And it is. So if you can't retain a great deal of it, just try and take away one or two things from it. Mind you, we'll go through these four quite extensively as the classes unfold. And then there's this lovely question about why the sequence? Why is it taught like this? Because when you look at truth of dukkha, this is an effect, and the truth of origin is a cause. Yet in the natural world, causes come before effects. So why not teach it like that? So we'll answer that to all of that. And so these are the major things from today's teachings. You, I hope you walk away from here with the idea that there are these four truths called Four Noble Truths. You will know what they are, being the truth of dukkha or truth of suffering, truth of origin, truth of cessation, truth of class, and you'll know why it's taught this way. But this is the major stuff to just take away. So there's a lot of detail here. That's the most important thing. You know there are four truths. You know why they're taught the way they are. Now, the four truths of noble persons, which I will consider I'll put there. These are the noble truths of dukkha, origin, cessation, and path. I think it was Robert Thurman, Professor Robert Thurman, who wrote something about this. And he just said, look, these are the four facts that people who are realized know. And these four facts came out of a sutra called Setting the Wheel of Dharma in Motion, or the first turning of the Wheel of Dharma. And these four truths, there's two sets of pairs here. So dukkha and its origin go together as cause and effect, and truth of path and truth of cessation are like cause and effect. So what's noble about these truths? So what makes, what's, it doesn't seem like suffering is anything that's noble, does it? So the word noble, let's have a look up for a thing. Noble refers to the people who realize these truths. It's not that the fact that the truths themselves are noble things, it's the people. And these people are called Aryas or Arahats, but you can also, they can say that the Bodhisattvas understand this too, and so do the Buddhas. Now, an Arya person, a person who's, this is the person who is noble. So the Arya understands these four facts. That the Arya is also known as a noble person because they know of these four facts. Now, Arya, the word Arya means person who has destroyed the foe. So you see sometimes when they praise the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, they call them foe destroyers. So in other words, something is being destroyed. The thing that's being destroyed is called a foe. You know, so you ask, well, who's this foe? So the foe that's being destroyed is principally ignorance. So people who have destroyed their own ignorance realize four facts about ordinary life. And these facts are suffering exists. This suffering has an origin. These origins can be destroyed and bring about a sense of peace. So what's noble is not so much the truth itself, but the person who realizes that truth. When you understand these four truths, realize and understand them, they ennoble you. That's why I said again, the person becomes a noble person. Now these truths are true for a number of different reasons. One is the perceptions of the Aryas are true. So what I said, and our perceptions are not true. There's a big difference here. So it's about perception. So we have, how we perceive things using our senses, don't we? So we want to perceive color and shape, we perceive them through our eyes and visual consciousness. If we hear sounds, we perceive them. So we perceive them with our ears and the consciousness associated with the ear, called an auditory consciousness. But this goes across for every type of sense and sense object. So these are perceptions. Right? Now the other side of the mind is where you can perceive something like that, and perceive your shapes, colours right there. This is my eyes, right? And then I say things like, oh, there's George. Oh, the floor is brown. Oh, it's nice light coming through. All that stuff is called conception. That's all the thoughts you have about what you perceive. Now, when we use our ordinary senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body stuff, so then we perceive the data of the world. But there's another way of perceiving also, and that is with mental consciousness itself. That to do that is not an easy thing to do. It requires a lot of training, but you can do it, which means that you see things with the mental consciousness. You understand or you know directly with your mental consciousness. And because these Aryans have developed this type of mental skill, they can perceive things as they actually are. And they call that true. Now, there's another the term in Buddhism called truly existent. You'll come across it. It says things do not truly exist. That's what it's often said, right? So what does that mean? Well, it means there's a sort of a disharmony or a disconnect between what you see, for instance, with your eyes, and how what you see exists. Now, those two are out of whack. So what I mean by that, for example, so I'm looking at you, and what do I see? I see the colours and the shapes of your bodies, right? That's what's appearing to my visual consciousness. At the same time, you appear to me to exist like out there from your own side. The colour and shape, you go, where's the colour and shape? Yeah, over there. That's what I'm looking at. The white, the blue, the white shirt, the blue shirt. Where is it? You go, like over there. Okay. So when you go to look over there for it, you never find it over there. And that's why I say it's not true. It's true that I see blue and white. It's not true that blue and white are over there, existing from their own side, existing from the side of your body in this case. Do you get that part, what I'm saying? You might not understand like how that happens, but you understand what I'm saying. So this is what I call it, for these things are not true, because there's a disconnect between the way they appear to us and the way they actually exist. Now, the Arya's perceptions are true. They see things how they actually appear to them and how they exist. That's correct, right? At least for ordinary people like us, it's not correct. Things are not true, although we think they are and we behave as if they are. So without analysis, without investigation, if I look at the chandelier, for instance, the chandelier appears to be like over there. Right? And all of us would just agree that that's the case. And we call that's a convention that we just all agree upon. This is like without the investigation. If we investigate a little bit deeper, we can see that the chandeliers depend upon different causes and conditions. They're made up of different parts and this sort of thing. Right? So that describes their conventional existence. Now, these phenomena here called chandeliers fit into a category of truths called conventional truths. And these conventional truths are all false. They're not actually true, they're false. You know, why? Why? Because the way they appear to us is not the way they actually exist. Like, for instance, if you look at them like this, do they appear to be changing?
No.
No, not at all. Are they changing?
Yes.
Yes. Do they exist from their own side? I want to look amongst all the parts of the chandelier for the chandelier. Would I find them? No. But conventional truths are false. But like I said, conventionally, we just talk about it like it's up there, and it does exist depending upon causes and conditions. So we've got three different levels of understanding that we've got to cultivate about what we call conventional. Now, when an Arya person investigates this phenomenon, they don't find the chandelier existing from its own side. They don't find themselves existing within their bodies. They don't find that themselves is the body and mind. They don't see any of that. What they find is the emptiness of the inherent existence of the person or the chandelier. So these perceptions are always true. But when they're in meditative equipoise upon emptiness. Because when they come out of course, like it all appears false again. But they know it's, they know it's false, they know it's not true. I'll give you an example, and it's a simple one. So when Kensa Rinpoche used to use the example of using different coloured sunglasses. So you can imagine that, that if we all had, say, sunglasses that produced a reddish type tinge to the world, we all had them, right? What would the world look like? That's how it appears to our senses, right? Is it red? No. How do you know?
Take the sunglasses off.
And then you take the sunglasses off and, oh gosh, it's not red at all. Well, that's what the Aryans have done. Right? So when they're meditating there, that, the sunglasses come off. They don't see a red world. Right? When they open their eyes up, there's a red world appearing, but they know it's not red. Right? Because they've taken the glasses off. In the same way, like for us, with our glasses on, suddenly we believe that these phenomena have what's called an independent existence. This is our sunglasses on. We take them off and go, my gosh, they don't have an independent existence. They have a dependent existence, that their existence depends upon my senses, my ability to name it, all that sort of stuff. Right? But this is the difference between how the Arya sees things and we see things. And I hope that analogy can sort of help us, you know, understand this a little bit better. Then what the Aryans do, of course, is they form what's called a non-deceptive explanation that will lead us beyond suffering. So I'm trying to do that myself, but of course I'm not an Aryan being. I'm just trying to give you some ideas about how this might sort of work. Why is it that we see the world like this and then somebody else, you know, with sunglasses on, and then somebody takes, and it's a different world when you take them off. Now, these truths are also true because if you wish to put an end to suffering, then dukkha and its origins have to be abandoned. In other words, so if we want to stop suffering, then we have to find out what is actually suffering and what creates it. And you go, okay, I don't want that. It's also true that if you wish to do this, the only way to, like I said, abandon suffering and its origins is to apply a true path to bring about the true cessation. That's also true. And so, you know, the Dharma books that we read, all these classes we come to, every teacher is trying to provide an explanation of what suffering is, how it exists, and what we can do to put an end to it. So when we look at the four, what they call the four noble truths, Geshe suggested it really should be said as the four truths that noble beings have realized. As others would say, four noble truths, doesn't it seem that the truths themselves are noble? It does to me. Yeah. If you say the four truths that such and such would realize, you go, oh, okay, these guys are saying something about truths. What are they saying? Then we're going to have a look. Do you have any questions about this little section this afternoon? Okay, so we'll go into now looking at each of these truths. So what I've done here is I've set up the truth, I've defined it, and then have a look at what are the most important things about this truth. So dividing the truth of dukkha. So, you know, we usually use the word suffering. The correct term is this dukkha, because if you just think of suffering, dukkha is much more than just suffering. So let's have a, see how it's defined. It's that which is counted as a contaminating effect and belongs to the thoroughly afflicted side of truth. That's its definition. So I was, the way I remember is you just grab the two parts and go, that which is counted as a contaminating effect. Okay, I'll run that to my mind a few times. That which is counted as a contaminating effect. Yeah, okay, the truth of suffering is an effect. So that which is a contaminated effect and belongs to the thoroughly afflicted side of truth. So when I first came to the center, Kensa Rinpoche was giving me teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and he was talking using language like this. I'd never heard any of it. And I've read books on the Four Noble Truths, and I don't know what he's talking about. I've never heard this term, thoroughly afflicted side of truth. I don't know what that is, what that means, but effect. Okay, I've got that part, I think I can get that part. Suffering is an effect. It's called a contaminated effect. So what's going on here in this sort of presentation is that we've got is like I said before, the truth of origin and the truth of suffering, they're one pair, right? Truth of cessation, truth of path, they're another pair. They produce different effects. The truth of suffering and the truth of origin belong to what's called the thoroughly afflicted side of truth. That was all we're talking about here is suffering, suffering and its origin. And suffering and its origin come about through afflictive mental states, mind states. So one of the major ones, of course, is ignorance. And then, of course, karma. So we've got ignorance and karma. These are the two major things that produce all the afflictions. So they belong to the thoroughly afflicted side of truth. And because of these karma and the afflictions, these two together produce the effect called suffering. So the truth of suffering, or truth of dukkha, that's counted as a contaminated effect. Why? Because the contamination has occurred through its origins. Karma and affliction. Now, each truth can be explained in a number of different ways. I'm going to first of all just say what the attributes of each of these different truths is. And then later on in other classes, we'll talk about why they were taught in this way and some of the benefits of teaching them in this way. Dukkha, or the truth of suffering, has four attributes. And the first is that it's impermanent, which means that suffering itself undergoes, if you experience any type of suffering, it undergoes change, as you're probably all aware of, right? Like maybe last week you had the flu and today you don't. What's really important to take away from this impermanence idea is that there's two levels. One is called really gross and the other is called subtle. So here they're talking about the subtle impermanence, how something disintegrates from moment to moment to moment. So rapidly, the second moment is no longer present when the next moment arises. So the first one is no longer present when the second arises. So it's impermanent. The second is not a satisfying state. Right, so this unsatisfactoriness is another way of describing dukkha. The most common one, like I said, they just put suffering in there. But here I put unsatisfactory. It's unsatisfactory because, of course, it's been driven along by karma and affliction. Then we have the two really interesting terms, empty and selfless. So let's look at selfless first. So self here, self, as you know, can refer to the person, the conventionally existent person. That's not what it means here. The word selfless here is referring to what they call the object of negation. This means that object that is not true, that we've got to discover its untruthfulness. So the object of negation can be described in a number of different ways. You know, one of them would be, for instance, one of the simplest ways is the object of negation here, there is no self that is permanent. So you go through, you examine, is the self permanent? You find, no, it's not. So if you ever thought it was, that would be the object of negation. If you thought that the self was a single entity, which is very easy to do, you would be wrong again. That would be the object to be negated. If you thought the self existed independently of the body and mind, or independently of the aggregates, that's the object of negation. So here, the most subtle object of negation is a self that could inherently exist, which means existing without depending upon anything else. And so that's what we're saying. There's no such self like that. But the self does exist. It's just in these ways it doesn't exist. And so the aggregates, our body and mind, are empty of such a self. There's no such self there like that. In terms of the truth of origin, this is why these two go together well. That which is counted as a contaminated cause and belongs to the thoroughly afflicted side of truth. So with the true origins produce the true effects, suffering. So the causes and the conditions, you get an effect. Here we're going to look at these two origins. What are the phenomena that cause suffering? So again, we have the four attributes. So they are causes. The second thing is that they are origins. So these causes, the word origin here means that the origins repeatedly produce new forms of suffering. And so in other words, karma and affliction, or karma and delusion, which are the two origins here, they repeatedly create dissatisfaction, suffering, unpleasantness. And they do it strongly. Okay? So in other words, if you ever had a really sort of like a really deep reaction to something, you didn't quite know where that came from, it was quite strange to you, that's what this is getting at. That our suffering is really quite deeply rooted in us. And you can also notice this when you find yourself, even though you might like to make a change or want to make a change, you can't because your old behavior gets in the way. It's like when you have this habit of doing this thing and it stops you doing the new thing you want to do. And fourthly, karma and delusions, they condition each other to produce the suffering. In other words, you cannot have suffering with just a cause. It needs conditions. So it's always causes and conditions together. But you know, we've used this example before. Suppose you wanted to grow something in the garden and you knew that it required a seed to do it, right? So you get a packet of seeds. Those seeds will be the causes for the vegetables or flowers that you want, right? They're not going to produce anything else other than the flower or vegetable you want, right? However, if you just leave it in the packet, what do you think is going to happen? No, no, go away. You're not going to get the flowers or the vegetables, right? So what do you have to do? You have to take them out of that packet. Go and find some earth, or you know, you find the growing medium, you're going to have to apply water, fertilizer, heat, all sorts of things, aren't they? They're all the conditions. Seeds to cause, the actual thing that's going to produce the vegetable flower, but you need all these other things, otherwise it's not going to take place. Same with us, right? We're saying here, what's the cause of our suffering? You know, it's got origins, so it's karma and delusion. Okay. So the karma is the seed. If we create an action, it left us got this potential to create something else. But it needs help. It needs conditions. Conditions for us is disturbing emotions. Disturbing emotions come in and they nurture the seed and we're reactive and we behave badly. That's how it sort of works. So I'm doing this very briefly, and of course in those books that I showed you, it goes into quite a lot of depth about each of these things if you want to read. But have I given you enough just to, you know, like I said, if I go in too deep and you know there's four of these, at the end of it, it's like you just got a whole mess of stuff that doesn't make much sense to you. So just get a few things, you know, would be enough for today. Now, so then we come to the other side of things, the truth of cessation and the truth of path. So the truth of cessation is defined as a freedom, I like this part, a freedom induced by the uninterrupted path which induces it, in which a corresponding obscuration has been abandoned. So I put this picture up because for me it demonstrates this, the definition quite simply. So you can see that he's got that the chains have been hit with that sledgehammer, haven't they? And so they've broken. And now the person who's been chained by them is free. So this is like a sense of a freedom. Right? It's induced by the uninterrupted path which induces it. So what induced the freedom from the chains here? Oh, sorry?
The hammer.
That's right. Without that hammer going whack down there, there's no way you can be free. So you need the hammer to go smash on the chains. And once you've done it, you're free. The same here, in which a corresponding obscuration has been abandoned. So here I see all these chains as the links of the chains as the obscurations. They will be called karma and delusion, but they're the things that are holding us bound. Once they're broken, it's like now you're free, right? Yeah. So now you start looking at yourself. You know, okay, now how can I apply this definition and this analogy to my own mind? So am I free at the moment? So, well, no. No, I'm subject to birth and death. I'm subject to being a prisoner to my own delusions. So I need to be free from that. So what is going to do it? What's the hammer that I'm going to use to free myself from these chains of karma and delusion? The answer is the wisdom realizing emptiness conjoined with bodhicitta. So that's the path. And when you apply this path, this wisdom, to your obscurations, these obscurations are wiped out. And that's what happens. Once they get wiped out, you're free. So you get little bits of freedom coming to the mind as the path is generated over time. So you'll find this yourself, right, as you go through this. Ideas you used to hold, they vanish. They're dropped. They're not re-picked up. Yeah, so each obscuration can be dealt with using the wisdom realizing emptiness and the mind of enlightenment. Now, what is this, these four attributes? So cessation means stopping. It just means you say, you know, something has stopped. It brings about a state of peace in the mind. The mind doesn't go back to do what it used to do, and so it's free of the affliction it used to have. A state of peace arises. Yeah, you could have found similar type of things like this yourself. I know I have. And this is just true. You know, you might have had an idea about something for some time. And if you look at it, when you look at that idea, every time you do, you become agitated. Like, you know, for example, many of us don't have very good relationships with our parents. Right? When you think back over that time, you could get a little agitated. Right? However, if you recognize all that and rethink it, you know, like one of the simplest ones is, oh my gosh, my dad had no idea how to behave. He was never taught this. He had no conception of it. So of course he's going to behave the way he did. You know, so you can sort of do this sort of analysis, and what you find is you won't become so agitated anymore. You have a different way of looking at things, in other words. Once you might have thought, you know, your parents knew everything and what to do, and they were just crackpots. But through this reason, you sort of look at the first two truths and go, oh my gosh, that's why my dad behaved the way he did. There's the suffering, there's the explanation of it. You could have put an end to it. You go, yeah, but he didn't know how to. You've got to forgive people like that, don't you? They just don't know what they're doing. They're trying to do their best. All that sort of stuff. You have to think, next time you think of your dad or your parents, you won't become agitated. You've got a new way of looking at it. You must say, poor dad, my poor parents. They never met the Dharma like I had. This had no idea. And so, you know, since the forgiveness arises, you're much more at peace within yourself. It's also called magnificent. And what's the other one? And freedom. And now we come to the path. So the path is described as an Arya's realization informed by the wisdom directly realizing the emptiness of inherent existence. So this emptiness of inherent existence, right, this is what they call the most subtle object of negation. So if things were to inherently exist, it would mean that they could exist without depending upon anything else whatsoever. And that's how things appear to us, but they don't exist that way. The Arya has discovered this through their analysis. And we can too, and we need to, before we become Arya beings, because we've got to get a conceptual correct understanding first, like as ordinary people like ourselves. Got to get that right first, then we can develop the deep state of concentrations that we need and sort of hold it on that object and rest and sentence. So this is really interesting, because you're going to find, like, as it says in the books, now, trying to get this right. So it says something like, there are true sufferings, but they don't truly exist. There are true origins, but they don't truly exist. So it's just, what it's sort of getting at, yes, these phenomena like suffering, its origins, do exist conventionally. They don't exist ultimately. That's what we've got to discover. And this is what the Aryans discovered, of course. So here we go. In the highest philosophical view, a true path is a specific type of wisdom. It is the mind that directly sees that nothing, not even the self, exists independently or from its own side. Usually we see things as having their own power to make us happy or sad. This wisdom proves that things are actually empty of that independent power. Things exist only because of causes, parts, and the labels that our minds give them. A true path is true because it is the only mind that is not being fooled by appearances. This is really useful to remember, because if you do this, you remember that, you go, gosh, every one of my senses is being fooled by appearances then. There's only one thing that's not, and it's mental. And I haven't developed that yet. So of course, you know, we are. Appearances will fool us when we forget that things don't exist from their own side. That's why we've got to sort of get a conceptual understanding first, and then keep refreshing it, cultivating it, and then going out in the world and looking at things and asking yourself, do these phenomena appear to exist from their own side? So you can just ask yourself that of me. I'm sitting up here with the statues, anything. Does it look like that object is existing from its own side? You might ask, what does that mean? You go, well, it's got to be like over there, like Eddie, it's got to be here. Right? You're looking at me, aren't you? Well, where am I? Right there, right? Right here somewhere. So you go, okay, I'm going to have a look. Because this is Eddie existing from his own side means Eddie existing from the side of his body and mind. Eddie and his body and mind are all over here. So then you look. And of course, Eddie's not found to be over here. And you do this with the afflictions. You know, like sometimes we describe ourselves as really being really bad people, don't we? Or I'm an angry person. It's like, okay, let's have a look. And then you don't find that you are truly angry, you don't exist as a truly angry person. The angry person is conventional. But we just call people that. They're not actually that. This is what you've got to keep sort of, it's tricky. Like I said, the inherent existence is any type of phenomena, it's often called self, that could exist from its own side without depending upon anything. That's called like independent, not dependent. You know, if you just take a moment and go, doesn't seem to me that I exist dependent upon my body and mind? Just ask yourself that question. Does it appear that way? It doesn't to me. I think, no, I'm fine. Body and mind are just sort of, they're not me. No, it is me. I'm fine. Now that, if you really believe that, you're going to get to all sorts of trouble. And yet many people do believe that. They do get themselves in a lot of trouble. A true path is true because it's the only mind that has not been fooled by appearances. It is a path because its clear seeing acts as a vehicle, carrying you away from the habits of stress and towards the destination of total mental freedom. is the wisdom. Is it, I've said a number of times, there are different ways of looking at this object of negation, and there are different what we call systems of belief about what is this object of negation. The most subtle school that all of, you know, and the learning is like a scaffolding experience. You sort of start off quite simply, and then you move, it becomes more and more difficult and more subtle. So when we do these analysis, the most, what the Buddhists did first of all, of course, was they looked at the beliefs of other people. The other people believed in the self or a soul. There was something independent of their body and mind. It was permanent, I said independent, and it was a single entity. So this is the first thing the Buddha looked at, is it could a self that had those properties actually exist? And he found no such self like that could exist. So the person had no self, it was permanent, independent, and single. So they say that's what the self was meant there. But yet there's still, you know, and then later on these other guys come on and said, you know, these are just ideas. Nobody actually thinks that. Nobody actually really thinks that their self is permanent. You get educated in that. So we don't really disagree with you. However, but there is an innate understanding that we have a self that possesses the body and mind, that owns the body and mind, that directs the body and mind. We all have that. Now, so then the object of negation becomes more subtle in the description. So what is that sort of person, you know? What words could we use to describe such a person? It's like somebody who's, the self could be like self-sufficient and substantially existent. But now the self's like a real thing, like it feels real to us, doesn't it? You get frightened, you know, and think you're going to die. Well, really happy, right? Doesn't the self seem to have some sort of reality there? You know, they look at that and they find no such self as there either. Now, okay, that's just to do with the person, right? Their selfhood, their identity. What about everything else? Doesn't that appear to have its own identity also? Like the body, more like the mind. And so these other Buddhist schools went further. They didn't just look at the identity of the person, they went body, mind. What about the things we own? What about the universe itself? Do these things also have this intrinsic reality or independent way of being? And the answer is, well, they certainly look as if they do, but then again, they investigate and they don't. So this idea of emptiness and selflessness changes over time. And the presentations are all slightly different too. So this path, of course, has attributes too. The first one is it's called path. So with all of these Four Noble Truths, if somebody asked you, for instance, give me one attribute from each of these truths. You know, from the first one, truth of dukkha, you could say suffering or impermanence. It's really simple. What about the truth of origin? You say origin. What about the truth of cessation? Cessation. Truth of path? Path. You got one down straight away. But then you can just grab another one if you like and just go, well, what about, what else can I say about path? Well, it's, I was going to say it's suitable. It's a suitable way of investigating reality. It does bring the accomplishment of freedom. And of course, it delivers us from states of suffering. The Dalai Lama says in one of the books, Samsara and Nirvana, he says, whether we initially approach the four attributes from the viewpoint of reasoning or meditation, we must later combine the knowledge gained from both to attain a yogic, direct, reliable cognizer that realizes path, suitability, accomplishment, and deliverance. This mind is what they call the yogic direct cognizer. This mind is a mental consciousness that's a unity of serenity and insight that directly realizes these four attributes. So in other words, so I'm introducing these to you now as concepts and words and try and get a deeper understanding of it. But then we have to take this information and apply it. And all we can do is like apply it with the mind we have at present. But you're going to realize pretty quickly that that it's not quite correct yet. What do I need to do to see this directly rather than just as an idea? This is for that, you have to develop what I call calm abiding. And this is a really deep state of concentration. Once you can have that state of concentration, now you can place your understanding of paths, suitability, all those things, place your mind on that with this mind and just keep it there. And that breaks down all the other ways you used to think about things and so forth. Yeah, again, as Holiness says, from the same book, these four attributes, asaj, doubts, meaning we can get rid of these. If we have doubts about these four attributes here, we can look at each attribute. For instance, he says, if you think that the wisdom realizing emptiness cannot counteract the afflictions, reflect on the second attribute, suitability. If you wonder if the wisdom realizing emptiness will actually eliminate all afflictions, ponder the third attribute. If you wonder if meditating with the wisdom realizing emptiness will bring nirvana and not some other state, reflect on the fourth attribute. And if you fear that there's no path to peace at all, reflect on the first attribute. So each of these attributes is a way to overcome wrong ideas that we might presently have. Like you'll see this when we talk in the next coming weeks and so forth on the path of suffering. That's really meaty. You find out, wow, well, you discover your view, the way of being in the world and where and how it lets you down. And for me, firstly, I've got to just admit to you all, I've been pretty shocked by this. Like I've been teaching here for nearly 30 years. And it was only like in the last year that some of this in the First Noble Truth was like, oh my gosh, that's what it means. So I hope that doesn't happen to you, but it has happened to others, you know. I mean, I remember Lama's like Rinpoche saying to himself, he thought he was actually practicing Dharma. You'd be practicing 18 to 20 years and realize he hadn't been practicing any at all. Right? So thank goodness he could say that. And then, of course, once he knew he was doing wrong, you change your way and you do it correctly. But firstly, you've got to find out, what am I doing wrong? Then we can make the changes. But if we don't know, we can't, can you? Okay, so now, what was the last class you guys did with me? The path, or was it? What was it?
Last
year. Establishing daily practice. So you might be familiar with the three scopes or the three capacities of a practitioner. Like we start off with the small scope. We just want to stop obvious sufferings. We can move into the middle scope and then the great scope. So each time what you're doing, you're trying to stop certain things happening and develop other things. That's the whole path is sort of set up like this. So in this next thing, I'll put up a table. We look at these Four Noble Truths and you show you what you're trying to do through suffering and so forth. That was sort of reasonably clear to me. So as you can see, now once I've got the Four Noble Truths, then right next I've got, this is how a person of small capacity practices. Then next, a person of middling capacity, and then a person of great capacity. So you can see it's a little bit different, isn't it? So when you look at the person who begins to practice the Dharma, they say this person has a small capacity of practice. What should they be trying to do here? What are the sufferings they're interested in? As you can see here, and this is how you see it, you know, presented with our courses, we need to be free from suffering. So suffering has different levels. You can have coarse suffering and very subtle suffering. So coarseness means obvious or easy to understand. So when we first begin to practice, the thing is they say, like, do practice like this. So at the time of your death, you don't find yourself in the lower realms. That's the most important thing. Just do not end up being reborn there. Right? If you have, you basically wasted this life, Rinpoche would say. So we look at, you know, the terrible things that can happen to us when we come to die. We realize that what's causing all that stuff? Those are the 10 non-virtues. So if we can stop engaging in the 10 non-virtues, that's the true cessation, we stop it, then you have freedom from that rebirth, a temporary freedom. Because remember, you could be reborn again as a human and then muck it up next time and find yourself in the lower realms, which is what we don't want to do, neither do we. It's always going to be terrible, right? So we don't want to find ourselves there. So how do we do that? Well, we abandon these 10 non-virtues. And that will make sure we don't have the effect of the true sufferings that take place in the lower realms. Am I making sense to you? Then when you become a little bit better at practice, you move up to this middling level. You know, you sort of sit there and go, yeah, okay, well, I'll do my best to escape the lower realms of this life, but I'm going to get the sufferings of these ordinary lives, aren't I? I'm still going to get born. It's going to be hard. Growing up as a child is difficult. There's sickness, there's death, there's losing all your money. There's all sorts of problems that come up. Right? You ask yourself, do you want to keep doing that for eternity? But you might go, like, no. Is there anything better? Yeah, you can come free of that too. So here, the true dukkha is having your body and mind under the control of the disturbing emotions. And you go, that's true suffering. As we know, the origins of this are the afflictive obscurations. So again, we have to stop them. The true cessation, freedom from rebirth within cyclic existence. We want to stop that whole process of having uncontrolled rebirths. How do you do that? The wisdom realizing emptiness, conjoined with renunciation, this idea of I don't want this to take place anymore. A little bit of thinking about this too, you'll realize pretty quickly, yeah, but what about my mother? What about my dad? What about my children? What about my brothers and sisters? What about all these people I love? Do I'm just going to be free from myself and let them suffer? And not if I can help it. I want to help my kids. I don't want them to suffer like this when I can be actually free and I know you can be. So I'm going to choose to help them. So you see, it's really hard to help people, isn't it? And so the great suffering of this person is they have no omniscience. They don't actually know what to say and do for each person. So they need to get rid of that. That's so I can directly know what to say, how to speak, what to do. But for themselves, they have this, that's their major suffering. The other thing is, of course, they recognize that the suffering they recognized in the middling place, everyone's still got that. It's like I'm saying, it's like this idea that I often give the example of being in prison or being in a hospital ward or going off to the execution, these sort of things. You know? So you can say, well, everybody's in the same boat. So in other words, this person of great capacity, has two types of difficulty going on here. One is, you know you don't have the capacity to help as much as you'd like to. That's a suffering. I'm going through something like this at the moment, looking after a young man who's dying. You can't stop it. You know? You're there to, you, Try and breathe from the bed, but it hurts. Everything hurts. And you're trying to do good. And not very good at it. That's what I find myself is. You hear they cry out, you know. It's difficult. So that hurts me. And at the same time, they're hurting too. So this is this thing of like, whoa, this is a true suffering. This is the suffering. I've got to stop this. You know, like what's its causes? So here it goes, the cognitive obscuration and the self-centered attitude. Again, the cognitive obscuration is this idea that the world appears independent of us. We just think independently of others and our world. That's a cognitive obscuration, because we're actually not. But we're all tied together, it's interdependent, that world of interdependence, aren't we? So that's one of the majors. The other is because the world looks like that, independent of us, we behave as if it were like that. So here it's now, it's like, what about me? I'm in this world, I gotta look after myself. Just me. But the sense of selfishness, that's the problem. And there's a great capacity. But it's not just me anymore, it's we. So we've got the self-centered attitude and the idea of this cognitive distortion of us being separate from the world we live in. So what's going to stop it all? Well, we've got to stop those cognitive obscurations, but they can only be stopped at Buddhahood. And this is the major difference of why it takes so long to become a Buddha. It's right, is to get rid of the cognitive obscurations, the sense of separateness and just being focused on oneself. And of course, there's these true paths. So the true paths are always in terms of the person of great capacity, wisdom, realizing, emptiness, conjoined with a method. So the method might be bodhicitta, it might be the method of bliss in terms of tantra. Just depends. Now, do you guys have any questions of what I've said? It's quite a lot to take in, isn't it? You might have different answers to that question. Yeah. So from the point of view of true sufferings, because of who's governing, who's running, you have to calm and delusion. And another one is, so when you say something, don't just say the mind, say the undisciplined mind, because the mind is also the source of happiness. So you can't have it, you know, it's an undisciplined mind that produces all our suffering, and it's a disciplined mind that produces our happiness and virtue. I like this. This is one of the things that Holly was saying. I'll just share with you. I think it's a good way to differentiate. You know, don't just go, oh, it's the mind. Because you're going to go, we've all got a mind. But that's all I can do, because you suffer. How's it been?
Anthea would like to ask, was there a definition for cognitive obscurations? Is it taking information through our senses, and our senses can only experience conventional truth?
Yes, our ordinary senses—that's right. Our ordinary senses can only produce. sorry, Anthea. Our ordinary senses produce. What was it you said, Billy?
Is taking information through our senses, and our sense only experiences conventional truth.
Yes, that's right. Until you use the mind to merge it with calm abiding and special insight. So that's the tool we use to get out, to make a path.
So is that the definition for cognitive obscuration?
I'll have a look in the text. There'll be something there. I think I'll have a look. So a cognitive obscuration. So you know, we've got afflictive obscurations and cognitive obscurations. The person who wants to become a Buddha needs to remove both of those. If you're seeking just your own personal liberation, then you need to remove the afflictive obscurations. Now, why do we even have these cognitive obscurations? Basically, it comes about through the habit of seeing yourself separate from the world. And so that, so when you see babies, right? They try to make sense of the world. They're always going out there. We're reaching all the time. They're touching things. They're licking things, right? Well, finally, I'm like, where do I fit in here? And there's a actually there's a, actually there's a I'm not, there's a shift in time, a shift that takes place over time, where the baby suddenly realizes that it's separate from the world. But before it was really like in the world and trying to make sense of it. But then the sense of self takes root. It's always been there. That's why I call it innate. And then now they become separate. And then all the words help to describe that, don't they?
I actually noticed that in my little nephew, who's about 8 months, just a month ago, he would gladly go to anyone. But then I hadn't seen him for a month and I went to see him and he's not even talking yet. But he saw me and went, oh, and went turned to his mum and went, oh, you're realizing that you can be hurt or scared and now you're reaching for safety with his mum. And I'm like, that was a month.
Yeah. Let's do our first meditation. Can this settle the body? So notice or feel the seat beneath you. Then check the length of your spine and make sure that your shoulders are dropped down. Let your breath flow without effort. Let the body breathe. Now set an altruistic intention. In brief, may this meditation help us attain the non-abiding Buddhahood to benefit others. So today let us look at these Four Noble Truths, and I think we look at what's most exciting about them, which is that suffering can be brought to a permanent end. We can stop suffering. Yet this state of peace is not something we need to go out and find. It's what remains when we surrender the struggle we have. About our existence. So imagine carrying a really heavy pack for miles and miles, and then having permission to just take it off and set it down. Our worries have been much like clouds just passing through the sky. All of our stresses have been temporary events. But the awareness of peace is always present. Clouds move through the sky, but the sky stays the same. Storms move through canyons, yet the rock remains untouched. Delusions appear to us, and then they vanish, having no substantial reality, being unfindable when searched for. So if you were at once angry, and then the anger cooled, the anger ceased, what remains? So peace is the natural state of a mind that has let go of reactive habits. This is a bit like pulling a hot iron from a forge and having that hot iron slowly return to its natural temperature. But can you imagine a freedom so complete that no external event could ever shake it? This is the final departure from the fear of being controlled by life. This is like a ship arriving in a harbour where the open sea can't follow. So today, when you have distressing, if you are to have a distressing thought or something difficult were to happen, just recognise that the state of peace is already here. So the state of freedom, this is always present. You just have to recognize it. Okay, now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth. So we have a last little section to go. So there's an analogy often given to describe these Four Noble Truths. And this comes from the Sublime Continuum. As you can see, it says, sickness is to be known. The cause of sickness is to be abandoned. Abiding in happiness is the aim and the medicine to be relied upon. Likewise, suffering, cause, cessation, and path are to be known, to be abandoned, to be experienced, and to be relied upon. So what is to be relied upon in this quote of the Four Noble Truths? What's to be relied upon?
The path.
Good, that's right. The path is the true path to be relied upon. What's to be experienced?
Cessation.
The true cessation. What's to be abandoned?
Suffering.
The cause of suffering is to be abandoned. And its origins. The cause of suffering, the origins of suffering are to be abandoned. And what is to be known, first of all?
Suffering.
Suffering, yeah, dukkha. We have to know what that is. Because it's very easy. Like I said, I told you I've been teaching like 30 years, only last year. It's like, oh my gosh, I suddenly got what the truth of dukkha is, how deep that is. It's like, wow. Maybe I've heard it, but I've never penetrated. Sometimes, it takes a little time. Just about over. So I will now cover. Why did the Buddha teach these truths, known by noble beings, in the opposite way in which they actually occur? Because the way they occur, isn't it, is you always have a cause and then you have an effect. Causes come first, then effects come second. Then the Buddha taught effect first and cause second. But why? So I've got like three different reasons here. And try and take one. Right? Yeah. So the purpose of the sequence is to show us the order of meditation. So this material is introduced to us, then we need to meditate on it, right? So meditate has got those three parts. You listen or you read first, then you think about it, contemplate, and then you become familiar with what you've been contemplating. So to become familiar with means you meditate. Now this is saying you do it like this way to know the order of the meditation. So he teaches origin first, then cause. Sorry, he teaches effect first, then cause. If you go another way, you go, okay, well then we can see the other way. Yeah. And this is just, I guess this is sort of going along with you, Kate. You know how this order, it works like this. It's not, don't go and do origin first and then effect. Go the other way. And another reason for this sequence is to help us develop a determination to be free. And what helps us to develop this determination to be free is to become, first of all, disillusioned. From here, the third reason is for us to overcome the wrong ideas. And what's the wrong idea that we primarily have here? Is that samsara is happiness.
Eddie, it's almost a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? Like the very first step is you've got to acknowledge you've got a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
And if you can't do that, you can't, all the other steps don't work.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so here it's like suffering has its origins and has causes. And if you wish to be free from it, you also have to find the means to do it, the path. That's another, these causes produce this effect of a cessation. So there are the three. For us to overcome a wrong idea, to help us to develop a determination to be free, and for us to show you more of how to meditate.
Anthea also added, it shows us what to pick up and what to put down.
That's right. Yeah. I do like that idea that Anthea just said what to pick up, what to put down. You make it really simple. And I do like get it simple first, then you can extrapolate afterwards. Right? But yeah, if you look at this path, this is all you're doing all the time. Putting down what doesn't work, adopting what does. And like the last of the Buddha says it, I think one of the things the Buddha describes as teaching, right? Is teaching like that, isn't it? I teach what to abandon, what to adopt, and to keep an eye on your mind. Be mindful. Okay, so our last meditation, folks, and then we'll finish up. So again, we'll sit centering the body. Again, refresh the altruistic motivation for practice. We're trying to transform our suffering into a path of universal peace. So have you ever noticed the sense of not having enough, even when things seem to be going well? This subtle unrest is what the Buddha identified as the first noble truth, or the first truth recognized by noble beings, is this subtle unrest. When we truly understand this, we stop resisting reality and begin to look for real cure, or real way out. So at present, our mind is a bit like stirred up salt, muddy. But we know that mud is not the nature of water. And imagine your mind is a clear lake that's become a little cloudy with this stirred up salt. So why is the water murky? Why is it cloudy? So the winds of craving and attachment are blowing across its surface. Now, when the wind stops, the silt settles naturally and the water becomes clear and calm. But how do you stop the wind? Well, we have to practice mindfulness and conscious living as many moments as we can. So, should anything, any frustration take place today? Just see it as a symptom, something you might find interesting to investigate rather than an enemy. And as you go through the day, remember that you are the doctor, you're the patient, and you're also responsible for the cure. So be kind to yourself. The Dharma is a path of healing. And breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale, put your eyes wide open. And like I said, today I hope you can all walk away with the knowledge of that there are four noble truths, why the Buddha taught them in this sequence. And over the weeks we meet again, there is a teaching on the four noble truths that you have in the FPMT readings on pages 5 and 10. See if you can just remember the definitions of the truth of dukkha and origin. So they're the ones are very similar. It's just one's a contaminated effect and one's a contaminated cause belong to the thoroughly affected side of truth. Next week, we're going to look a bit more at the truth of suffering, and in particular, the three categories of suffering. So, you know, you're probably aware that suffering can be described, or the truth of dukkha can be described in a lot of different ways. Next week, we'll look at it as they call the dukkha of suffering, the suffering of change, or the dukkha of change, and the dukkha of all-pervasive conditionality. You know, we'll look at those and then why look at them? What's the impact that we're hoping to produce? Okay. Are there any final questions that you'd like to ask? Have I left anybody here confused or anything like that? I hope not. We've got a few more weeks to go. I've still got a chance to do it here. Okay. So, thank you for being here, putting in the effort to listen and stay awake and think about this material. So let's dedicate the energy we've generated towards your full awakening for yourself and all living beings. Well, join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into their enlightened state. Now, this enlightened state depends upon the mind of enlightenment, and the next verse is about that. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. Here we have the prayer for His Holiness's long life. The wish granted, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled.